Well, as you know, we're working our way through the book of Deuteronomy, and we are ready to finish up with chapter 6. This has been kind of a long series here of this section, but this is really a profound section. We've talked about the Shema, how the Lord said, the Lord our God, the Lord is one, and we should love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, and strength. That's a very profound and important statement that we looked at, and then it goes on to talk about teaching these things to your children when you rise up, when you sit down, when you're coming and going. It talks about binding these things upon your hands and your forehead and your home and your hometown. So we've taken a good amount of time to talk about all those things because those are serious, profound principles that we need to put into our lives. And then as we go through the rest of chapter 6, we have other ideas that are equally profound, equally important for us to apply to our own life. He talks about here not falling into idolatry. He talks about remembering these things. And then he reiterates this idea of teaching them to your children. So at the beginning of the chapter and at the end, he emphasizes this idea of repeating these things, teaching them to our children, making sure that our kids pick up these things, we explain these things to them, and so that the faith can go on to future generations. So let's go ahead then and look at chapter 6. We've already looked at some of these things. In verses 1 through 3, we saw the intent of the covenant, that Israel was obligated to obey God's commands as they entered the promised land. God expected them to fear him and to obey him, to fulfill the commandments that he had given them. We talked about the greatest command, to love the Lord your God, as we talked about the Shema, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. We talked about the propagation of that command, to teach these things to your children. And then in the remainder of chapter 6, we have how to preserve or how to keep these commandments in a practical sense. What are we supposed to do then? How do we maintain our love for God? Or you might say, if we truly love God, like it tells us to do, love the Lord your God with heart, soul, and strength, how do we do that? These are practical ways of putting that into application. In verses 10 through 12, it says, when you conquer the promised land and settle there and begin enjoying all the resources that God has provided, beware lest you forget God. So chapter 6, verse 10, the Lord will bring you into this land which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Houses full of good things, in verse 11, which you did not fill, hewn out wells which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant. Then, verse 12, beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. So the expectation was that when they came into the promised land, all these things would be provided for them because the Canaanites had been living there for centuries. They had developed, they had built, they had produced all these fine things for the Israelites to come in and use and to take for themselves. Now, normally when a conquering army came into a territory, what would they do? They would destroy the whole place, and then maybe after, once they'd conquered it, then they'd have to rebuild. Well, of course, the Israelites are supposed to come in and conquer, but they were not supposed to destroy all the valuable things because these were the things that the Israelites then could use once they occupy the land. They were definitely supposed to destroy all the people, the wicked people, the Canaanite people, because of their idolatrous ways, because of their immorality and their debased culture. They were supposed to destroy all those people, but not destroy all their property and the land. But then the warning is, once you get there and start enjoying all these things that God has provided, beware lest you forget the Lord your God. Somebody put it this way, Israel's newfound wealth and spirit of self-sufficiency and pride would quickly lead to forgetfulness about what Yahweh had rescued them from. Remember, they came out of the land of slavery from Egypt. This, in turn, would dull their sense of covenant understanding and obligation before God in loving him exclusively and keeping his commands. So you get into a place, you start prospering, things are going well, and it's not too long before you forget what God has done for you. They conquered the promised land, or they will conquer the promised land, but then forget what God had done in giving them that land. The warning here, I think, is necessary because humans in general, even believers, even those who are committed to God, may forget the good things that God has done and what God has provided for us. We tend to forget how others have helped us or how others have blessed us. We tend to take credit for the things that we have. We work for them, we earn them, and we forget that God gave them to us. Every good and perfect gift comes from God, the book of James tells us. So we tend to either credit ourselves or forget the good things, and we also tend to forget the promises that we've made to God. The covenant was a conditional one. If they obeyed the Lord, he would bless them. And so in achieving these blessings and conquering the land, they should remember it's God who gave us the ability to conquer. And there is the promise that we made because of God's blessings. If we are to inherit these blessings, we must obey the Lord. So sometimes we receive the blessing, we even make a promise, we make a commitment to the Lord. And yet once we enjoy those things that God has provided, we tend to forget that we had made those promises to obey and honor the Lord. As I was thinking about this, it reminded me of an occasion just a few weeks ago when there was a fellow who I'd known from previous years, like several years ago I'd met him, and he came into the church. He found me in my office and basically had a sort of a tragic story and difficult things that were happening to him, and he had no groceries in his refrigerator. And so I talked to him for a few minutes, and I said, well, I can probably, you know, help you out. And we went and got some groceries for him, and he's got four or five kids at home. And so the last thing, when I dropped him off at home, the last thing that he said was, I'll see you at church on Sunday. Well, do you suppose he showed up on Sunday? No, he has not shown up. He's not shown his face around here in the last several weeks. So he received the benefit. He made a promise, but then he never followed through. Now, maybe, I mean, to be charitable, give him the benefit of the doubt. Maybe he's working every Sunday. I don't know. Maybe there's reasons that he can't be here. Maybe he's in the hospital. I don't know what his condition is right now. But when you receive the blessing, you make a promise, and then you don't follow through. That's kind of the warning. The people of Israel are going to get to the promised land. They're going to enjoy all these blessings. And then all of a sudden, oh, where did we get all this stuff? We had made a commitment to the Lord. We'd made these promises to obey his word. And now we're not doing that. That's the warning. That's the potential for any one of us. It could be, obviously, we're not exactly like the children of Israel in this regard, but still, we receive blessings from the Lord. Maybe we pray for these blessings. God provides all these things. God expects us to be obedient, and then all of a sudden, I can't do that. I won't do that. I have other priorities. In spite of the fact that God has given me everything that I have, my commitment to God is minimal. As soon as I get what I want, I'm satisfied, I'm enjoying my life, and then God takes second place. Well, that's the warning that we can fall into as well. Not only personally can we do that, I was thinking as well another application of this. I think we do this nationally. Think of that in verse 12 again. Beware lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Is there any sense in which America as a nation has forgotten the Lord their God? If you think about the history of our nation, how we were founded by the Puritans or by the Pilgrims and why they came here and how they established this nation under God, and now is America at all guilty of forgetting the Lord their God? Now, obviously, America is not Israel. We're not saying that. But there are some similarities in the sense that America was founded on Christian values, on Christian priorities, you might say, on a foundation of Christian values. And now, what's remaining of those Christian values? Not much. I mean, there are still Christians, obviously, here, and we're still trying to promote those values. But as a nation, we are turning away from those things. And what has been the result of that? Chaos. Decline. Virtually every way that a nation can decline, our nation has declined over the last 50 or so years, or even 75 years. And I think a lot of that is attributable to the fact that the nation of America has, by and large, or is in the process of forgetting God, who brought them out of slavery, not in the sense that we came out of Egypt, but many of our people came from Europe, Northern Europe, and found a better place here and established this nation on Christian values. And now we're in the process of forgetting the Lord our God. And that's a great shame. And I think it's going to result in great tragedy, as it already has. Instead of forgetting God, what should we do? In verse 13, you shall fear the Lord your God and serve him and shall take oaths in his name. Now, why would they take oaths? What is the taking of an oath? In taking an oath, you're calling upon God as a witness that you are doing something, you're fulfilling a promise. You're asking God not only to vouch for the fact that you're promising to do something, you're also saying, curse me if I fail to fulfill this promise. So you're appealing to God, and to do this on a regular basis would be to verify or validate the fact that you are going to do something. You're making a promise, and you're asking for God to bless you in that fulfilling of the promise, and even curse you if you fail to fulfill in that promise. And so it's a way of recognizing God in the basic or the daily aspects of our lives, to call upon God to verify that what we're saying is true. Of course, in the New Testament, Jesus says that we don't even need to, or we shouldn't need to, swear in God's name to validate something, because he says our yes should be yes and our no should be no. And so although they did that in the Old Testament, it seems like we shouldn't have to do that today, because we ought just to be honest, and we shouldn't need to swear on the Bible or swear in God's name that something is true, just to validate that what we're saying is true. He goes on to say, to avoid idolatry in verses 14 and 15, you shall not go after the other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you, for the Lord your God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of the Lord your God be aroused against you and destroy you from the face of the earth. In chapter 5, we have the Ten Commandments, and the first two of the Ten Commandments is, no other gods, and do not fall into idolatry. Do not worship them, bow down to them, do not recognize any of the gods of the heathen. So God, he says, is a jealous God, and he will destroy you from the face of the earth, he tells the Israelite people, if they turn to idolatry. The promise or the covenant was conditional. If the people would obey, God's agreement with the people was, if they would obey him, keep his covenant, and keep his commandments, then God would bless them. But if they turn from that faithfulness, turn from obedience, that they would be destroyed. God would allow judgment to come upon them. And if we read chapter 28, if we ever get that far in the book of Deuteronomy, if you ever read chapter 28, the first 15 or so verses are all promises of God's blessing. If you obey the commandment and keep my word and follow me and love me, these are all the ways that God is going to bless you. 15 verses worth of that. And then there are about 45 verses of cursing. If you fail, if you turn from me, if you become idolatrous, then God is going to bring all these curses upon you. And so the conditional nature, that is, this is the agreement. If you follow me, you'll be blessed. If you turn from me and fall into idolatry, you will be cursed. Because, he says, God is a jealous God. God is not sinful because of jealousy. Sometimes we think of jealousy as a sin for ourselves. But what is God's jealousy? It's his desire to protect and keep what belongs to him. He alone deserves certain things because he is the greatest being. He is the creator. And so what does God deserve from us? Worship, respect, fear, obedience. And when we don't render that to God, God gets jealous, you might say. He does not receive what he deserves from us. And so he says the judgment would fall upon somebody in that way. He says, against you and destroy you from the face of the earth at the end of verse 15. So there are certain things that God deserves from us. In fact, remember Jesus said, render unto Caesar the things that belong to Caesar and unto God the things that belong to him. He's talking about taxation there. Should we pay the taxes? Well, give to Caesar what he deserves and give to God what he deserves. Now, what does God deserve? God deserves our worship, our obedience. God deserves our commitment. God deserves to be the highest object of our concern. And when we turn away from God as the highest good and the highest goal, and we pursue something else as the highest goal, that is, in a sense, idolatry. And that stirs up God's jealousy because we are giving to something else what only God deserves. Now, each one of us can look into our own hearts and say, is God the highest object of my concern? Is God my love, the thing that I love, the one that I love the most, with my heart, soul, and strength, as we learn about in the Shema, loving God with our heart, soul, and strength. So is he the highest concern that we have? Some of us might say, well, if I were to be honest, God is not number one in my life. There are other things that are more important to me than God. I'm willing to compromise. I'm willing to turn away from God, even sin against God, because I have a higher love. Well, what is that? That's idolatry, essentially, turning away from God, giving to others what only God deserves. Your love, your obedience, your commitment, that has to be number one. In fact, Jesus, you remember in the New Testament, says when you do that, that may create problems. It may be that that would divide, cause a division between you and your family members. So we have to decide what is going to be the most important, what is most significant in our life. It has to be God. God has to be number one. His call upon us and our obligation to Him has to trump everything else. And if we don't do that, we'll be guilty of idolatry. Well, this passage also reminds me of the goodness and the severity of God. Remember, there are these promises of blessing at the end of verse 15, and destroy you from the face of the earth. Throughout the book of Deuteronomy, Moses says, I lay before you a blessing and a curse, life and death. So here's the blessing. If you obey and if you remain faithful, all these blessings. If you fail, if you turn away from me, especially sink into idolatry, here's the cursing. Well, that's a New Testament principle as well. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. If we sow to the flesh, of the flesh we will reap what? Corruption, destruction. If we sow to the Spirit, we reap life everlasting. So we all have choices to make in this life. Are we going to sow to the Spirit? Are we going to please God and serve Him and obey Him and reap the blessings of that? Or are we going to sow to the flesh and do whatever we feel like doing and give in to our appetites, give in to our sinful desires and reap the reward of that? Well, there's the goodness of God in all the promises, but there's also the severity. God is both good and severe. Obviously, the best choice to make is to put God first, do what He wants us to do, obey the Lord, be faithful to Him, and receive all the blessings that He has for people who do that. Let's go on to verse 16. You shall not tempt the Lord your God as you tempted Him in Massah. Now, what in the world happened at Massah? You may not be familiar with that event. The word tempt here could be translated as test. Of course, we know that God cannot be tempted by evil. So people can't tempt God. They can't solicit God to evil. There's no way that we can make an appeal to God on the basis of evil, because God cannot be tempted by evil. The word tempt here really means to test. To test God is to make demands on Him that violate His character or His nature. It's the same thing that Jesus said to Satan, "Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God." Obviously, Satan could not appeal to Jesus on the basis of evil, but Satan could try to get Jesus to do something that's outside of his character. So to test God is to make unrealistic demands of Him, to put Him to the test. Now, what happened at Massah? It says, as you did at Massah. In Exodus 17, it relates this experience where Israel lacked water, and they complained to Moses, and God allowed Moses to strike the rock. That's that occasion where Moses struck the rock and water came out of it. And here's what Exodus 17:7 says. So he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah because of the contention of the children of Israel and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" That was the temptation. Can God take care of us? Is God really among us? So the sin involved here was doubting whether God could provide for them in the wilderness. Instead of trusting that God would provide, they doubted God's presence. Now think of that situation and that historical context there. All these things that the Israelites had seen, the plagues of Egypt, and then all the miraculous things that happened in crossing the Red Sea, and all the other things that were going on through God's miraculous intervention. They'd seen all those things. And yet, they still complained, "Is God among us?" He was there at night in the fiery pillar. He was there during the day in the cloud of pillar of cloud. And yet, they were questioning whether God is really with us. Is God actually able to provide for us? And so, that's the testing of God. Does God really care for us? Is He going to provide for us? They doubted that God was with them, and they demanded some miraculous intervention for God to provide for them. And you know, there are people today who do the same kind of thing. There are people today who believe that they can command or demand of God various things that they want. They not only ask God for things, they demand things from God. And obviously that, I think, is putting God to the test. Is God among us? Is God really with us? Is God really here? Is He going to provide for us? The Bible tells us that we walk by faith, and faith leads us to believe that God is with us. Sometimes we may not feel or sense the presence of God, but Jesus said, "I will never leave thee nor forsake thee." He said, "Behold, I'm with you always, even unto the end of the world." So we can believe, we do believe by faith that God is with us, even right now, where two or three are gathered together in my name, Jesus said, "I am with you." So We trust that God is with us. We trust that God is providing for us. We don't put God to the test. We don't make demands of God. In verses 17 through 19, then, diligently keep the commandments of the Lord your God, his testimonies, his statutes, which he commanded you. You shall do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord, that it may be well with you, and that you may go in and possess the good land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to cast out all your enemies from before you, as the Lord has spoken. So again, the exhortation or the expectation is that they would obey their obligations regarding this covenant that God has made with them. If they would obey, then God would bless them. The key in verse 18, I really like this expression, do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord. Boy, those are words to live by. When we consider all the temptations and all the things that come to us through this world, what is our goal? What are we trying to do? Well, we say we're trying to glorify God. Well, what does that mean? Well, this expression, I think, summarizes what we ought to be doing in a moral realm, especially. Do what is right and good, and notice, in the sight of the Lord. Many people are trying to do what is right and good in the sight of the world, or in the sight of their friends, or in the sight of the law, perhaps, or in the sight of pop culture. But our obligation, our commitment ought to be do what is right in God's sight. And we know what is good in God's sight because the Bible has told us what is good and right. And so that ought to be our commitment, especially when we're faced by the temptations of this world. Okay, my obligation, my commitment is to do what God says is right. Simply obey his commandments. Success for Israel hinged on obedience to God's commandments. And success for us as well, as individuals and even as a nation, hinges on obeying God's commandments. And then Moses finishes the chapter here in verses 20 through 25 with another exhortation to pass these principles and these values down to our descendants. So notice verse 20, when your son asks you in time to come, saying, what is the meaning of these testimonies, the statutes, the judgments, which the Lord our God has commanded you, then you shall say to your son. So the idea or the scenario is that the young people come along and say, what's the meaning of all these laws, all these rules that we have to keep? Do you remember how many laws and rules there were in the Old Testament? That is, prohibitions and commandments. If you put them all together, how many are there? The Jews, the traditional number is 613. That's a lot of rules to keep. And so obviously as young people grow up and they start, you know, making sense of this world and they look around and they see all the rules that the Jews had to keep, they might ask this question. What is the meaning of this? What is the meaning of these testimonies, statutes, and judgments? We have all these laws. Why do we have to keep all these laws? And so then he says in verse 21, we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt. The Lord brought us out of Egypt with a mighty hand. The Lord showed signs and wonders before our eyes, great and severe, against Egypt, Pharaoh, and all his household. He brought us out. I like this statement in verse 23. He brought us out from there that he might bring us in. He brought us out of Egypt to bring us into the promised land. So notice the statement of intention there. God intends, that was his purpose, bringing them out to bring them in. Because this was the land, notice it was the land that God had promised to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. So he showed these signs and wonders. He brought us out. The Lord commanded us to observe these statutes, to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive as it is this day. So this was for our benefit. This was a good thing. We ought to obey these commandments because it's for our benefit. This was God's intention to bring us out, and then he gave us these laws. Of course, on Mount Sinai, God gave the law to Moses. So it's important that we explain these things to our children. We don't just say, oh, it's our tradition. It's just our religion. It's just what we do. No, instead, Moses says, when your children ask about this, explain it. Explain it to them so that they can understand it. I think our children ought to understand why we believe the Bible, why we go to church, why we make our life or live the life the way that we do. Kids are naturally curious, and they're going to ask about it. Why do we have to go to church on Sunday? Why do we have to do this, that, and the other? Why do we live this way? Well, don't just say, oh, we just do it. I don't know why we do it. We just do it. It's just tradition. No, we have to explain these things to our children. It's important that we do that we give them good reasons to believe and to adopt our faith. Many children, of course, we know, and we can give examples, many children do not retain the faith of their parents or of their mother and father because they don't see the need for it, or they don't understand it, or they don't see the benefit of it, or they were never trained in it. Remember, fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Well, some children are not brought up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. They're not trained into these things. They're not taught, either at home or in church, these things, and so they just let them go. They don't hold on to them. Some people never accept it for themselves. Well, as parents, we should instruct our children carefully and intentionally what we believe and why we believe it. Now, we can do that, of course, in the context of the home. We can do that through the church. I mean, we delegate the responsibility to the church to teach our children the faith. But obviously, that has to be undergirded at home. It has to be, it all begins at home with the parents. And then, of course, the church can come alongside to help that. So we want to demonstrate why these things are important to us. We want to explain it to our children, why this matters, why we live our life this way. They should understand it, or at least impart that to them to the best of our ability so that they would do so. Some children reject the faith because their parents, frankly, are hypocrites. There are parents out there who bring their children to church and they act one way at church, they act all religious and holy at church, but then when they go home, it's a whole different thing. All of a sudden, the language is not godly. All of a sudden, the actions are not biblical or Christian. But we have this religion that we do on Sunday, so we go to church, we put on this happy face, or we put on whatever it is, our nice clothes, and we go to church, and we behave in a certain way there, but that's totally inconsistent with the rest of our life. Now, when you raise children in that kind of environment, what are they going to do? They're going to come to the conclusion, eventually, this is just an act. This is just a show. There's really nothing to this. We do something like this on Sundays, but the rest of our life, it's totally different. So children can see hypocrisy a mile away, and if you as a parent are living a hypocritical life and not applying biblical principles at home, well then don't be shocked when your kids deny the faith. When they come to the place when they're, whatever, 15, 16, 17 years old, and all of a sudden, or maybe they go off to college and somebody give them a reason not to believe, all of a sudden they've decided, you know, I know better than mom and dad, and I'm going to turn away from the faith and leave Christianity behind. That happens a lot. That happens all the time. And there may be various reasons for it. The danger is that succeeding generations lose the history and the meaning of their faith. They just don't see how it applies to them. They don't see why it's a benefit. They don't see why it's believable. They see maybe their parents are not living it out. And then they drop the faith altogether. So we want to do everything we can to avoid that outcome. Now, of course, we can't control our children, especially when they get to a certain age. They're going to make the decision that they're going to make. And obviously, there are those who are prodigal children, and they turn away from the Lord temporarily, and we trust and hope that they'll come back to the Lord. But we have to do what we can do. You know, we have to follow those admonitions and exhortations to train up our children in the things of the Lord. Notice in verse 24, the Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes to fear the Lord our God. Notice the parallel nature here. Commanded us to observe these statutes to fear the Lord our God. How do we fear the Lord our God? We observe his statutes. We observe his judgments. We observe his commands. That is, we obey them. We listen to God and we do what he wants us to do. That is how we show our fear and respect for God. And then the last statement here in verse 25, then it will be righteousness for us if we are careful to observe all these commandments before the Lord our God as he commanded us. Now, this is an interesting statement because it almost sounds like Moses is saying here, if you observe these things, that will constitute righteousness. In other words, you'll be righteous in God's sight because you observe his commandments. And there is a sense in which righteousness is observing the Lord's commandments. That's true. But as we look at that, and we especially compare it with what the New Testament teaches, we know that we're justified, that is, declared righteous, by what? Therefore, being justified by faith, we have peace with God through our Lord Jesus Christ, Romans 5:1. So we know that righteousness ultimately does not come by keeping the commands of God. In fact, we just talked about 613 commands. How many people kept all 613 commands? Or maybe not even that, maybe just those that pertain. I mean, some of those commands don't pertain to us or pertain to every single individual. But who keeps the Ten Commandments? I mean, everybody falls short of the glory of God. We've all sinned. The command structure that's given to us in the Old Testament shows us repeatedly that we can't keep the law. The law is a burden because nobody can keep it. And even in the Old Testament, we have indications that we're not saved by keeping the law. We're not ultimately justified or made right with God by law keeping or keeping God's commands. Example would be in Genesis 15:6, Abraham believed the Lord and it was counted to him for righteousness. It's the same word, righteousness. So the righteousness ultimately does not come by keeping the commands, at least not saving righteousness. Righteousness as a lifestyle, of course, comes through keeping God's commandments. But as far as being righteous in God's sight comes by faith. Even in the Old Testament, Abraham was justified by faith, by believing in the Lord. And so we should not be confused that somehow we add to our own righteousness or our right standing with God does not come through obedience to God's commands. Now, it's very important that we do obey God's commands and we are righteous in a day-to-day lifestyle sense when we keep God's commands. But as far as saving righteousness, as far as the righteousness that we need to go to heaven, that's granted to us only by faith. Somebody said that true covenant keeping in the final analysis is a matter of faith, not merely of works or ritual. We understand the value of keeping God's commands, but ultimately we're justified not by command keeping, but by faith. Well, as we finish up chapter 6, remember it's headed in chapter 6 by the Shema. The Lord your God, the Lord is one. The Lord is one God. We worship the Lord our God only. We love him with our heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then the result is the rest of chapter 6. What are we supposed to do if we love God? If we truly love God with our heart, soul, and strength, well, we'd have no other gods. We wouldn't worship any other idols. We don't bow down to idols. We don't worship idols like the heathen do. We don't learn our religious practices from the wicked, evil heathen people. We teach these truths to our children. We talk about them around the house. We explain them. As we're coming and going in natural rhythms and patterns of life, we teach our children these things. We remember what God has done for us. We affirm that everything that we have comes from God. Just like the Israelites, when they come in and take over in the Promised Land, they have all these houses and vineyards and things to keep themselves going. Everything comes from God. Remember that God is the source of everything we have. We remind ourselves about these truths regularly as if they are bound to our hands, as if they're bound to our head, as if they're written on our doorposts and gates of the city. These things are surrounding us. We're reminded. We keep our focus on these things. We believe and trust that God will provide for us. We don't make demands of God. We submit to God and trust that he is going to provide for us and that he is with us. And we diligently keep God's commandments and explain them to our children. That's what we would do if we truly loved the Lord our God with our heart, soul, and strength. Well, let's close in prayer.